The Wall Street Journal reports roughly 310 alleged cases of conflict-related sexual violence in Ukraine, with about 280 of those victims identified as men. Welcome to Debug the Hype. I'm Alex Morgan, and this show is not affiliated with Reddit or any subreddit. Today's date is July 27, 2026. That investigation is the first thing we need to unpack. Brazil just refused visas to two senior U.S. State Department officials, Assistant Secretary Riley M. Barnes and Deputy Assistant Samuel Sampson, after a July 20th request to meet Brazil's electoral authorities. Brasilia said the visit looked like a renewed attempt to politically exploit the situation, while the State Department called the trip routine. This matters because it comes ahead of Brazil's October 4th presidential vote and risks normal to nervous diplomatic escalation. Watch this one as a sovereignty test. If more partners see routine election contacts as interference, international coordination on election integrity could strain. The Pentagon quietly shifted four U.S. service members from its Iran campaign death tally into a new overseas operations category on the Defense Casualty Analysis System, briefly creating a confusing public count that ranged from 18 to 14 before officials said the anomalies were being fixed. The human cost reported by the administration still hovers near 18 dead and over 600 wounded, but the reclassification triggered complaints from lawmakers and families about transparency. This matters because casualty accounting is a key check on policy. When numbers get moved around, Congress and the public have less reliable oversight.
And the lighter one from Europe. Czech President Petr Pavel attended the Hungarian Grand Prix as an accredited photographer, wearing a purple media tabard while shooting trackside images. It's a human moment, a sitting head of state visibly doing a private hobby. But it also revived routine questions about security and protocol when leaders step out of formal roles. The optics here is simple. Relatable politics can cut both ways, humanizing a leader or inviting scrutiny over access and special treatment. What changed? The Wall Street Journal pulled together testimony from Ukrainian prosecutors, UN investigators, and former prisoners alleging a pattern of sexual violence by Russian forces, including rape, genital mutilation, electric shocks, and other abuses. And the reporting cites roughly 310 alleged cases of conflict-related sexual violence collected by the UN, with about 280 male victims included in that tally. Those are blunt figures. They're the anchor for a story that shifts how we must think about both evidence and accountability in the Ukraine war.
Start with the evidence. The reporting names specific sources, Ukrainian prosecutors, UN field investigators, and survivors who spoke to journalists. One survivor quoted in the piece, Serhii Boychuk, described being raped with bottles and sticks and having a knife pressed to his genitals, and said, "They wanted to psychologically break me." Investigators reportedly found repeated similar methods across different detention sites. The public significance is twofold. First, the scale and pattern, hundreds of testimonies, suggests these are not sporadic crimes by rogue individuals. Second, if coordination or consistent practice can be shown, the legal threshold for command responsibility rises. As former international prosecutor David Schwendeman put it to the Journal, no one in command could claim under the circumstances not to have known what was happening. That line is important because it frames potential prosecutions beyond lone perpetrators and toward those in positions of authority. But let's be disciplined about what's known and what still needs work. Testimony is powerful, but also fragile. Survivors' memories, physical evidence preservation, chain of custody, and corroboration matter for any future prosecution. The reporting is based on interviews and investigators' summaries. Kremlin officials declined to comment. Independent forensic corroboration, medical records, detention site logs, intercepted orders, even satellite imagery that corroborates the existence and control of detention locations will strengthen the case. International criminal law requires robust evidence to attach responsibility to commanders or to characterize a practice as a crime against humanity.
So what happens next?
There are several possible paths, each with practical constraints. One option is referral to an international tribunal, such as the International Criminal Court, which already has investigations into the conflict. The ICC can issue arrest warrants and pursue prosecutions, but it needs state cooperation to arrest suspects, and some key states are not cooperating with the court. Another route is hybrid tribunals or ad hoc mechanisms, models used after Bosnia or in Cambodia, which combine international expertise with domestic prosecutorial reach. Those can be faster in some respects, but require the host state's political will and security to operate, which is a problem in active war zones. There's also the question of timing and priorities. Prosecutors and human rights investigators routinely balance immediate documentation, preserving witness testimony and medical evidence, with long-term legal strategy. That means funding and protection for survivors, secure evidence storage, witness protection programs, and mental health support become legal necessities, not just humanitarian ones. If evidence rots, investigators lose the ability to build cases that stand up years from now. Politically, the allegations are explosive. For Ukraine and its partners, they reinforce narratives about the brutality of the invasion and will likely shape Western discussions on further sanctions, military support, and legal aid for documentation. For Russia, these accusations will be dismissed domestically as propaganda. That rhetorical divide makes international enforcement dependent on third-party cooperation, arrests at borders, extraditions, asset freezes, rather than on an immediate change in Kremlin behavior.
Look at precedent. After the Balkan Wars, prosecutors used patterns in detention operations, repeated methods of abuse, and documentary evidence to pursue both commanders and political leaders. Those cases were slow and costly, but they produced convictions and a historical record that mattered for reconciliation and reparations. If investigators in Ukraine pursue a similar path, they'll need patient, durable support from states and NGOs for years, not months. There are also practical obstacles that deserve attention. Survivors need long-term support. Evidence collection in wartime is dangerous, and some detention sites are behind front lines or held by irregular units with limited command structure. That complicates the command responsibility theory. Investigators will need to isolate where orders came from, formal military channels versus local commanders acting with impunity, to decide whether reprisals can reach the top. That's why the David Schwendeman quote is more than rhetoric. It signals the prosecutorial argument we'll likely hear. Consistent patterns imply higher level knowledge and therefore higher level liability. What do communities and online observers add? The thread responses across forums have been a mix of outrage, calls for immediate international action, and sober reminders about due process. Commenters emphasize survivor resources and the need for secure reporting. That public pressure can push governments to fund investigations, but it can also drive politicized narratives that make impartial legal work harder. The balance is fragile.
So what should we watch for in the weeks ahead? First, whether the UN opens a formal public investigation linked to the journal's reporting. That would mobilize forensic teams and evidence preservation units. Second, whether the ICC or a coalition of states signals intent to pursue arrests or indictments. Look for language about command responsibility. Third, concrete funding and protection programs for survivors. Without those, witness testimony can't be safely preserved. A short reality check. International justice is slow. Accountability often arrives years later. But this reporting matters right now in shaping policy. Even if legal outcomes take a decade, the documentation itself constrains impunity, supports sanctions dossiers, and builds the historical record that future courts or truth commissions will use. Now let's pivot to money and markets, a very different kind of system strain, but one with equally wide implications. J.P. Morgan economists warn that two long-running forces that helped keep interest rates low for decades are fading: fiscal discipline and favorable demographics. That's a direct quote from the bank's note arguing the demographic dividend of the last 40 years is ending, and they put big numbers on the fiscal side. Global public debt near $100 trillion, and combined
combined public and private debt approaching $251 trillion.
Why does that matter? Because when governments run large deficits for long stretches, investors demand a higher term premium on long bonds, the extra yield lenders want for locking up cash for years, and that pushes up mortgage rates, corporate borrowing costs, and government's own interest bills. Meanwhile, aging populations change the underlying supply and demand for savings and labor. Fewer workers, more retirees, and increased pension and healthcare spending squeeze public finances and reduce the pool of global savings that helped keep real rates low. Let me walk through the mechanics in plain terms. For decades, a growing global workforce and rising saving rates, partly from emerging markets, increased the supply of savings relative to investment. Banks and pension funds bought long government bonds, holding yields down. At the same time, many countries kept deficits within perceived limits, so investors didn't demand big risk premiums. Now those twin supports are fraying. Demographics tilt toward retirees, not savers, and governments across advanced economies and emerging markets are running larger structural deficits. The bank calls that shift fiscal dominance, meaning fiscal needs start to overwhelm central banks' capacity to keep rates low without monetization risks. What are the likely outcomes? The bank scenario isn't a fixed date for a bond market crash, it's a higher baseline for where term premia and borrowing costs end up. Practically, that means mortgage rates are more likely to stay higher on average than they were in the era of ultra-low yields. Corporations will pay more to finance growth, squeezing margins or pushing firms to pass costs to consumers. And governments will face tougher choices: cut spending, raise taxes, or accept higher interest bills that crowd out other priorities.
There's a political layer here. Aging electorates typically favor generous social spending, which makes fiscal tightening politically costly. Immigration can offset demographic decline, but it's politically fraught in many countries and doesn't erase near-term fiscal gaps. Productivity growth could help, but it's a slow fix and uncertain. Reddit economists were split on the note, and that split maps to two scenarios policymakers face. In one scenario, central banks and fiscal authorities coordinate. Structural reforms, targeted fiscal consolidation, and policies that raise labor force participation could keep yields manageable. In the other, markets reprice long-term risk. The term premium moves decisively higher, and we get a period of tighter credit conditions that could slow growth, complicating repayment dynamics. What should households and policymakers do? From a household perspective, the practical advice many economists give is to lock in long-term borrowing if you expect rates to rise, and to expect lower returns on safe assets like long-term bonds than retirees once counted on. From a policy perspective, the reasonable playbook includes strengthening fiscal frameworks, clear medium-term targets, encouraging immigration policies that integrate labor, reforming pension systems to be sustainable, and sharpening public investment to raise productivity. There are also global spillovers. Higher safe rates in advanced economies can pull capital away from emerging markets, making their borrowing more expensive and risking debt stress. Currency swings can amplify inflationary pressures in import-dependent countries.
One more technical note. The bank highlighted the asymmetric cost problem in military terms for another story we covered this week: cheap drones versus expensive interceptors. But the economic parallel is the same. When an imbalance exists between what's needed and what's available, the fiscal bill to correct it can be huge. Rebuilding stocks, paying pensions, or funding healthcare all add up. The $100 trillion public debt figure JP Morgan cited isn't just a headline. It's the scale that limits how much governments can borrow without pushing investors to demand higher returns. So what's the listener's takeaway between these two deep stories? Both map to a single theme. Institutions matter for justice and for markets. Whether it's documenting abuses to make legal accountability possible or rebuilding credible fiscal frameworks to keep markets calm, we're seeing how the quality of institutions and the political will to support them determine outcomes. In the short run,
expect headline volatility. More sanctions, more legal claims, higher bond yields and fits and starts, but the longer-term outcome depends on whether policymakers and societies invest in systems that preserve evidence, protect vulnerable people, and sustain fiscal health. If international law and bond markets both hinge on institutions being willing to pay short-term political costs for long-term stability, the next year will be an acid test of whether democracies can make those investments. I'm Alex Morgan. Debug the hype.